And thank you for joining us from Beijing, Sim Chi-in, or it's easier for me to call you just Chi-in.
Yes. Thank you, Tia, for calling and having me on the show.
Thank you. Because your artwork, can I say like artwork, the Tin Man now is like still on the display in your dreams by UNSW, University of New South Wales, right? And before that, I heard that the Tin Man as well exhibited for the Sydney Festival 2018, right?
Yes.
So early on.
That's correct.
Nice. This is not the first time you publish it, as in like show it as a showcase, right?
It's the first time it's been exhibited, but this project actually originated as an assignment for the French newspaper Le Monde. It was shot in 2014 in Bangka, the island of Bangka in Indonesia, off the eastern coast of Sumatra.
Right.
But it hasn't actually been exhibited anywhere in the world before. It's been published as a newspaper story and also online previously.
All right, but this is the first time as an exhibition then?
That's right.
Okay. And what's the purpose behind it, actually?
Well, initially, the assignment was from Le Monde, and I have had a long interest in migration and labor. And I published a first book, actually, on Indonesian migrant workers, migrant women workers, or, you know, they're known as DKI, who traveled from Java, mostly Central Java, to Singapore and Malaysia to work. So my very first book, published in 2011, was about this. And labor and migration have been kind of themes in my work. So when I landed this assignment from Le Monde to go to Bangka, I took it up readily because it dovetailed very well with my personal interests. What we were trying to do with this project was to photograph the supply chain of tin, which is a very prized and important commodity today, because tin is made into solder wire, which is in many of our electronics, such as our smartphones, our laptop computers, our flat screen televisions. And there has been some controversy over the sourcing of this tin. If you recall, many years ago, there was a campaign to use, there was a campaign over so-called conflict minerals from Africa.
Yeah.
Especially from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So what happened was the supply lines moved towards Bangka and Belitung as a supplier of tin. So these days, companies that make a lot of electronics can say they have conflict-free tin supplies from Bangka and Belitung. So we wanted to go and see and trace where our tin from our electronics actually comes from. So we went out there to try and find the people who actually mine this mineral from the ground. And in Bangka, where we were, it's the earth is very rich in tin. So, as you know, traditionally people there did what is called dulang washing, which is just taking a pan to the river and slowly panning it for the tin deposits. So we were able to see some of the more traditional methods of tin mining, but then the more interesting and I guess visually spectacular form of tin mining that has evolved now is mining it from the sea.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to go out to sea with some of these workers, and I guess I'll never forget what it looks like. You know, we were maybe about 3 kilometers off the coast, and it was this whole kind of flotilla of huts on what they call pontoons. They're basically just wooden huts floating on the water.
Okay.
And then there's men diving into the sea, with they're holding onto these giant suction tubes. And what they do is they dive to the bottom of the sea and shove that suction tube into the seabed to dredge up the earth, and then that is washed down for a little bit of tin deposit. So this is actually, I mean, it looks kind of innocuous, but it's actually very dangerous work because the suction tube, sometimes these men who are diving with very rudimentary oxygen and breathing apparatus, sometimes they get sucked. Their body parts get sucked or
in the tube.
Their diving mask, by the tube. Or their diving mask gets sucked off, and then, you know, and it's impossible to see underground because everyone is diving and sucking the ground, the seabed, and it's completely murky underwater. Yes. So they're just diving blind and shoving these tubes into the seabed to dredge up this tin. And, you know, NGOs that follow this at the time told us, you know, each year a number of men die from this kind of diving. And if I don't recall wrongly, the daily wage these divers got was something like €8 or €10. So it's very dangerous work for very little. For the kind of soda, for the kind of tin that becomes soda wire in our appliances. So, you know, it's kind of like trying to trace where some of these things that are used to make modern electronics comes from. So that was the idea with the overall idea with this project.
Right. And you not just took pictures of them, but also having like an interview with them?
Yeah, I did some interviews with some of the workers that we were able to spend more time with. And we also tried to track down people who claimed that they were, you know, pirates. They illegally supply tin up from Indonesia up northwards because the big smelting plant, there are smelting plants on Bangka, but the big smelter is actually in Malaysia. So the tin has to travel north to eventually become solda wire, which is used in our smartphones. So yes, I did some interviews as well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's why at some sort you say that in theory this is illegal actually, right?
Yes, a lot of it was illegal. Some of it was legal. But most of the people I was able to photograph was illegal. Most of the offshore, the dredging in the sea is illegal. If you know what Indonesia is like then, or much of Southeast Asia is like then, the line between legal and illegal is kind of fuzzy and it's all a little gray. The fact that I was able to photograph openly speaks a lot about how relaxed Indonesians are in general.
Yeah.
I'm usually based in China where it is much harder to photograph illegal activity. But in this case, most people were quite hospitable. There were some people who were aware that what they were doing was illegal and didn't welcome being photographed.
Right.
But they were quite gentle in how they let you know. You know, they might just pull their hood, they wear a hoodie and they might just put their hood up or they'll cover their face or something.
So no one said to you guys like, okay, no, you can't do this here. No, just bring your camera out. No, not really.
Well, I have to say, I know that this story was sensitive to begin with. And I know that there have been other journalists who've been asked to stop and been escorted out of those locations.
Right.
But I think we were lucky in that we worked with a very good local fixer and producer, and we were able to kind of not stick out too much. Well, I'm ethnic Chinese, and I'm kind of tan, so I don't really stick out. You know, I'm just like I don't know. I mean, I often get into places and not get into too much trouble. So, yeah, in this case, no, we didn't have any direct opposition to making this work.
Okay. In fact, how long or how many days that you guys like did the project?
I think we were there for about 10 days or 2 weeks or something like that.
Even for roughly 2 weeks, you went out there and took their pictures, and there's no rough opposition from that.
No, I mean we didn't. We went back to some places more than once, and there were locations that I returned to for better light or better activity. To get the best possible pictures, but we were on the move most of the time.
All right.
So, yeah.
Okay. But you said that when you saw them or you were like taking pictures of them, what did you see in them, actually, this tin miner? It's like sadness or happiness because eventually this is money for them, or neither, or what?
I mean, I think we sometimes go into stories with certain assumptions, and I think that could be an unhelpful thing. I mean, in general, I just go and document what's in front of me and then try not to be too interpretive about what I'm going to see.
Yes.
So the workers are regular workers like any other kind of worker you will meet. You know, they are just doing their job and they're just doing their best for a better life, and they know that they're there to support their families. I mean, there was one diver that I spent more time with, and I went home with him to meet his baby and his wife.
Wow.
And that's the guy that you see in some of the pictures. He spoke more to me, and he expressed a lot of fear in what he does.
Okay.
So he puts on a very brave face. You know, he just does it kind of as a matter of fact. But actually, when I spoke to him, he did say, you know, with every dive, he fears losing control of the suction tube underwater, and that would be the end of him. So he works with a lot of fear. And of course, you know, we went home with him to meet his wife, and I think their baby was quite small at the time, not even 2 years old yet.
Okay.
And so, you know, it's really, I think quite often migrant workers have the same kind of stoic attitude that this is just what they have to do. This is their lot in life, and they are fighting for a better life for their children. So, you know, he was fearful, but very stoic about it.
Right. Okay. And the project itself, like, sounds like you had no difficulty in getting the pictures or the stories out of them. So was it what happened?
Maybe sometimes we make it look too easy. No, it wasn't an easy story to photograph. It took a lot of research, and it took a lot of hunting for the spots, because these people are itinerant. I mean, they're doing something that's not legal, so they move from place to place, and we
right.
had to do a lot of, you know, looking and hunting for them and sounding people out to figure out where they were, and then having, you know, taken a boat out to see with them, you know, you have to kind of act in a kind of respectful and sincere way to gain people's acceptance of your presence and explain to people why you're documenting them, and hopefully they understand that you don't mean to do any harm, but, you know, you're just trying to shed some light on the conditions they work in, and shed some light on where a lot of the electronics we use these days, where the tin comes from. In fact, most of them that I spoke to didn't know what the tin they were dredging is used for. You know, they themselves use very simple non-smartphones, right? Like a Nokia or something.
Right.
They had no idea what the tin is for. I mean, they just sell bags of it, sacks of it, every day to the middlemen. One other big challenge that we faced while there was that I managed to get my eyeball burnt in a smelting plant. So we wanted to try and trace the tin from the time it comes out of the sea to the time it's made into an electronic product. So we had to photograph all the stages in between as far as we could. So
right.
we tracked down an official state-owned smelting plant. It's a legal plant, and this plant buys all the tin that is, you know, the raw tin material.
Okay.
And then it smelts it down into molten tin and then makes them into ingots. And then the ingots get shipped to Malaysia. So in visiting the smelting plant, we were given some safety equipment, including a fluorescent vest, and I think we were given boots and helmets. The only thing we were lacking were goggles.
Okay.
And I got, I was photographing the smelting, and I was quite near a cauldron, and one of the workers turned around and started spraying cold water into the cauldron.
Right.
Which then boiled over, and a piece of molten tin then flew out very high in the air, and came down and smacked the corner of my left eye. So my left eyeball was burnt by this molten tin, which had solidified by the time it hit me. So I was taken to the sick bay of the smelting plant, and the woman who was, I think, the appointed sort of nursing aide she flashed a torchlight in my eye, mm-hmm. and she dropped the torchlight and she ran out and she shouted, bakar. And, you know, I don't speak Bahasa Indonesia much, but I know ikan bakar, which is grilled
which
fish.
Is burnt so, fish.
So I said, you know, can you please tell me what is bakar in my eye? Like, you know, what are you saying? What is burnt? And so anyway, the long and short of it was that the insides of my eyelids and a little bit of my eyeball was burnt. And it was fine in the end. I was taken to a hospital and I was very lucky that it hit the corner and not the center of my eyeball. So that was you know, some drama on the trip.
But, that's the challenge.
Yes. But otherwise, I think it was an important thing to document. I think, you know, we use all these products without sometimes thinking about the cost, the human cost and the environmental cost that comes with our consumption. So, you know, I mean, I don't mean to guilt trip everybody. I myself use, you know, a lot of these smart phones and
equipment
and all that too. Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of inevitable in our work and, you know, the way we work now and with our kind of lifestyle. You can completely opt out, but, you know, it's not so simple. I think, you know, the least we can do is to be more mindful of not over-consuming. Like, you know, do we really need that new phone? Do we really need that new laptop? And, you know, and not create so much, on the one hand, create so much e-waste, and on the other hand, create a bigger demand for these products.
Mm-hmm. But if there's no bigger demand, they won't get more money, no?
Sure, but I'm, you know, yeah, it's a chicken and egg thing, and we, you know, we can feel bad for the fact that they will have fewer jobs, maybe, but I'm sure that other industries that they can redirect their labor towards, or maybe that's wishful thinking. I don't know. Obviously, there's a kind of a tin rush, you know, equivalent to the gold rush in Bangka and Belitung, and it's created a lot of jobs for Indonesians from poorer parts of the archipelago, but it is very dangerous work.
Yep. Talking about these, the Tin Man, is it or is it not actually one of your favorite work so far?
I think it's important that I did this work. I don't know that I don't really have favorites.
All the favorites?
No, there's certainly many other projects that I've spent much more time doing. You know, I did a project on gold mining in China, and I spent 4 years on that. So obviously some stories go a lot deeper, and I've put a lot more emotions and time into it. I think Tin Man was important to have done at the time. It was a very substantive assignment piece. I was hoping to be able to go back and extend the work, but I just haven't found the, you know, the ability or the funds and the bandwidth to do so. And other people have worked on this since, so I think it's, you know, it's been covered.
Nice. And at the moment, you're researching a book about Cold War, isn't it?
Yes, I'm researching and making a book on my family history, which is tied to the early Cold War in Southeast Asia.
Nice. I suppose more great works will come from you, Chi-Yin.
I keep doing my best.
You did. You've done many. But thank you so much for joining
with
us. Thank you so much. And even now you're in Beijing.
Thanks very much, Tia, for having me on the show.